So there I am, like a loser, standing in line at the post office, as losers do, when it hits me, brah, if I had just used stamps.com, I would have never had to stand in line at the post office again. I mean, there's a guy at the counter who's been arguing for 15 minutes about why he can't get his package. The lady in front of me must have won the perfume overdose lottery, and the little kid behind me is sneezing everywhere because his parents don't make him cover his mouth. Man. If I had just used the Stamps.com trial at scottsigler.com/stamps, I would have got $45 in real USPS postage, a digital postal meter, and I could print real postage using my computer and printer. So don't be a loser, man, and don't catch the bubonic plague from that kid. Go to scottsigler.com/stamps and give Stamps.com a trial. And now, on with our story.
Welcome to the serial audiobook Alone. An unabridged podcast of Book 3 of the Generations Trilogy. Written by Scott Sigler. Performed by A. Kovacs. This novel is available in print as an ebook or as a full-length unabridged audiobook. For links to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Audible, please visit scottsigler.com/alone.
Hello, junkies! Here we are with episode number 4 of Alone. It is book 3 of the Generations Trilogy. If you have not heard Alive and Alight, I suggest you go check those books out. What am I working on these days? Is what people always ask me. Well, just like last week, I am working away on Mount Fitzroy, which is the sequel to Earthcore. I hope to have the first draft of Mount Fitzroy done in a month or so. So probably by Alone episode 8, am I right around there? And then it is on to the second draft of GFL book 6, which is rockin'. Oh, so much stuff is coming your way in 2018. So much stuff. Save your ducats, because we got a lot of stuff coming your way. It's going to tickle your liver and your kidney too. So let's get you caught up on the story, and then we're going to make like a Hawkman and dive! Previously on Alone. The birthday children have spent many months preparing for the arrival of strange, unknown starships. As Em gathers more information about this inexorable engagement, she sees that the pressure is causing internal conflict as well. Her people are getting short with each other, even violent. Will this corrosion spread to the loving couple that is Spengate and Gaston and their child? Find out next on Alone, episode number 4.
Six. The observatory is the heart of Ukmal. The control room is the heart of the observatory. Omatiotl, the living computer, is the heart of the control room.
Welcome back, Empress Savage.
I have barely set one foot in this room, and I'm already annoyed.
I've told you to use my name, not hers, I say.
Louder than I normally would, because I'm speaking to the room, not a person, and for some reason it always feels like I need to shout to be heard.
As you wish, Omatiotl answers. Welcome back, Em. You have been missed.
Maybe the computer hidden within these stone walls thinks so, but apparently no one else here does. The people in this room barely notice my arrival. This is the place where O'Malley was overwritten. The place where I killed him. The place I killed old Bishop. Other people died here, too. Several brave Springers, old Dr. Smith, the overwritten Coyotl, and a few grown-ups whose names we'll never know. This was a place of flame and smoke, bullets and blood, hatchets and hate. But as with so many other things on Omayokin, we have changed its form. The room once held golden coffins designed to wipe out our minds and replace them with the minds of the grown-ups. We removed those coffins. In the space where those little death factories stood, we erected a dozen pedestals that are used for education. We cleaned the walls and ceiling, scrubbed away the char and soot. We painted everything bright white, including the mural showing human sacrifice. We removed the twisted metal X where the overwriting process happened. We turned a temple of evil into a classroom where humans and Springers alike learn how to make a better world. In a way, we overwrote this room. Take that, Matilda. Every one of those dozen pedestals is in use, yet the students barely give me a glance. They seem upset. Maybe Spingate's lessons are more demanding than usual. In the center of the room sits the well, a waist-high red metal wall that encircles the dirt shaft leading down to a paracel. Etched on that wall, the carbon symbol, an outer ring with 4 dots, an inner ring with 2 dots, and a solid circle at the center. That same symbol is at the very top of the observatory. It was also atop the ruined church where Spingate and I first talked to Barca. In the past year, we've learned it's the symbol of a forgotten Springer religion. We don't know what the symbol meant to Matilda and the builders of Ukmal, or why the race she tried to exterminate would have already been using it before the Zulatul arrived. Symbols. So important to the grown-ups that they embedded them on our foreheads. The double ring, spirit, representing religion. The gear, mind, our scientists. The half circle, structure, the engineers who build machines and make this city run. The circle crosses of health, our doctors and teachers. Our soldiers, the circle stars, aptly named Might. And of course, the empty circles. Service. Slaves. But what does the carbon symbol mean to the church? At the back of the room is a wide, waist-high platform with 6 more pedestals. On the platform stand Teresa Spingate and Xander Gaston, my 2 closest friends, and Halim Horn, Spingate's top assistant. Halim is unique among us, a circle star that doesn't like to fight. The other circle stars look down on him for that, even Bishop. Bishop sees no problem with other symbols wanting to fight alongside the circle stars, but one of his own wanting to be anything other than a warrior? To him, that is a betrayal of their birthright. But it doesn't matter what Bishop thinks about it. Out of our 275 people, we have only 7 gears. That's 7 scientists to handle almost all of our needs. Halim's desire and ability to help Spingate frees her from some things she'd consider to be drudge work. Halim hides his circle star symbol behind a white strip of cloth he's tied around his head. On that headband, he stitched a new symbol, an empty circle like mine, but with a diagonal slash through it, the ends of the line protruding just past the circle's outer edge. He says the symbol is called a null set. It represents his lack of belief in our symbols. I don't think he should be ashamed of who he is, or trade one symbol for another, but that is how he identifies, and I have no issue with it. Spingate and Gaston look exhausted. They always do. They work long, hard hours. They're the only ones who make me feel lazy. And having a baby, I gather, doesn't exactly help them get more sleep. Gaston scratches absently at his thick black beard. He won't admit it, but I'm convinced he grew it to annoy Bishop. Bishop's best effort to grow a beard resulted in a thin scrabble that looks like he glued sparse bits of hurricane fur to his cheeks. He's annoyed someone so much smaller than he can do something he can't. As if Ramsay's Bishop needs facial hair to show how manly he is. Gaston's hands were glowing images floating above a pedestal. A cloth sling runs from his left shoulder down to his right hip. Nestled inside the cloth is a lump of noisy and often smelly delight known as Kevin Spingate Gaston. They named their baby after my O'Malley. Teresa is also lugging about a baby, but this one is still inside her. She's 6 months pregnant with their 2nd child. Yet here she is, working away. Hello, Spin. She looks up from her pedestal, seems confused by my face for a moment. Oh, hello, Em. You're back. Is she glaring at me? Spin, are you okay? She blinks rapidly, then gives her head a little shake. The confusion seems to clear. I'm fine.
Come on up and join us, please.
I step up onto the platform. I walk to Gaston first.
Hey,
he says. His hands and eyes remain fixed on the pedestal display, but he turns his body so I can get at the baby.
Wow, Xander, I didn't know you missed me so much.
He grunts once. I pull little Kevin free of the sling, and Gaston returns his full attention to his work. Kevin is so clean, so soft. I love the way he smells, except when his diaper needs to be changed, of course. He has Spingate's eyes, Gaston's nose and chin. Without a doubt, though, the thing I love most about this child's face is his little forehead. Because Kevin has no symbol. He is the first human on Omeokan without one. He has no legacy of slavery or dominance, of being a have or have not. He has no memories of what he's supposed to be, of a life that others have planned for him. When he grows up, Kevin Spingate Gaston can choose whatever path he likes. That makes him a symbol unto himself, a symbol of what this planet can be, of what our people can be. I turn slightly, for some reason showing the baby to Spingate as if she's never seen the boy before.
He's so wonderful, I say. He's perfect.
Finally, she smiles. There is the beauty that is my best friend. Thank you, she says. He is growing so quickly. He is at that. I've only been gone 10 days, but it feels like the baby has doubled in weight. I bounce him up and down a little. His mouth opens in a toothless grin that is the spitting image of his mother's. She gently pets his head, brushing aside his thin red hair.
Spin, you and Xander seem a little angry, I say. Is everything all right?
You mean besides the fact that we have 3 alien ships above us, Zubiri can't get the optical telescope to work correctly, and we have an antenna that won't let us communicate with the Zolidal, which we need to do if Bello is going to tell us anything about why all these ships, including ours, came to Omeokan?
Her words mirror my own frustration.
Yes, besides that.
Her nose crinkles as she thinks.
I don't know.
She speaks quietly, so that only I can hear.
I just feel more aggressive lately. I've yelled at Xander for no reason a couple of times. He was a good sport about it at first. He tried to be patient with me, but a couple of days ago he started yelling back. We're getting mad at each other, and we don't know why.
She nods towards the students down on the floor, working away on their lessons.
Them, too. They're so grumpy. We've all been working so hard. I guess the pressure of the approaching ships is getting to us.
It's that, and more. Much more. The way Baudin acted. The belligerents gathering to attack us. The way Barkha has changed. I am gifted at solving puzzles no one else can figure out, but for this, I'm at a loss. I push those thoughts away to the back of my mind. Most often, that's where I figure things out, when I'm not really thinking about them.
There's something else, Spingate says, her voice a tight whisper. I've been having nightmares.
What about?
She starts to speak, then stops. She looks at little Kevin for a moment, then shakes her head.
Never mind, she says. It's nothing. I'm just not sleeping well is all.
Whatever the dreams were, they disturbed her. I know this girl almost as well as I know myself. When she's ready to talk to me, she will. Until then, getting any information out of Teresa Spingate is like trying to get blood from a stone.
But do I know her?
She's changed. The Spingate I thought I knew would have never thought torture was acceptable.
Well, I hope everyone feels better soon, I say. Then, loud enough for everyone to hear, what's going on with the alien ship?
Spingate looks at Halim.
put it on the main display.
He nods, works the glowing controls floating above his pedestal. The air above the red well flares to life. Spingate and I stand together, waiting. Gaston joins us. Without a word, he gently takes Kevin from my arms and nestles the baby back into the sling. The image forms. I've seen it so many times in the last 6 months. A small sphere of blue and yellow and brown represents Omiokin, our planet. Hovering above it is a red dot labeled Zolittle, our ship of nightmares that traveled over 1,000 years to get here. Then there are the three unknowns. A blue dot represents the first alien ship. When we discovered it, Omatiotl labeled it Beta 1. Gaston didn't like that generic name, said he wanted his enemies to have a face, whatever that meant. He renamed it Basilisk. Farther out, a yellow dot, Gamma 1, renamed Goblin. And beyond that, a green dot that represents Delta 1, renamed Dragon.
The Basilisk is thousands of miles from the Zolittle, but both ships have a line of sight on Ukmal, he says. I think the Basilisk will settle into final orbit in the next 2 days. It probably can't safely launch shuttles until then.
2 days. We might be at war in just 2 days.
Do we have any way of communicating with it?
Gaston shakes his head.
Not unless the antenna magically fixes itself. Even if it was repaired, I'm not sure if it would work. Since you left to fight the belligerents, the electronic interference that screwed up our communication system has gotten worse.
I think of the Jules and Borjigan's message board problem.
Could the Basilisk be doing that, I ask, or one of the other ships? I don't think so, Gaston says. Whatever the problem is, it seems to be originating from Omiokin, not from space.
More bad news. I need the antenna to work so Bello can talk to Matilda. And if war does come, we may need to communicate with this a little anyway.
So even if we fix the antenna, I say, it won't work because of this interference?
Spingate shrugs. Hard to know. The antenna is directly connected to the power plant down in the well, so a working signal would be exponentially stronger than anything the Jules or the message boards produce.
It might overpower this interference. I've still got Nevins, Pura, and Harmon working full-time on fixing it. Opkick has been helping them search storage rooms for parts, but so far they haven't been able to repair the damage. When we first climbed the observatory's 3,000 steps and reached the top layer, we saw a tall stone pillar decorated with our symbols. At that time, we didn't know the pillar housed an antenna meant to let the observatory communicate with the Zolittle. At some point in the 2 centuries after Ukmal was built, a power surge of some kind damaged the antenna, cutting Matilda off from the spiders and from the construction robots that built this great city. I stare at the simple blue dot representing the Basilisk. The blankness of it tears at me. Because of the radio telescope spread out across the city and in the jungle, I know where the alien ships are. But for now, we have no idea what they look like.
How about the repairs to the Goffspear telescope?
I ask. When will those be complete? I need to see this ship.
Soon, Gaston says. Zubiri thinks she's getting closer.
I try to control my anger.
You've been telling me soon for over a year, I say. Maybe that word means something different to you than it does to me.
His face twists into a snarl.
Then fix it yourself. If you know so much, you do the God's damned work.
I take a step back, shocked at his response.
Gaston, Spingate snaps, don't take your frustration out on M. Oh, it's all right for you to be a bastard to me, but I can't be one to M. Sure, that's fair.
She points a finger at him.
You shut your stupid mouth. Your attitude makes me sick.
I'm dumbfounded. Since we landed on this planet, these two have been inseparable. Their love perfect, patient, and kind. Yet here they are, screaming at each other. Gaston takes a step towards her, But before he says anything else, little Kevin starts to cry. The sound shocks Gaston and Spingate out of their sudden burst of anger. Their faces turn red. Spingate steps to Gaston and puts her arms around him. He hugs her back, the baby between them. Comforted in this sudden embrace, Kevin stops crying. "Maybe you two need a break from work," I say quietly. Halim comes closer, flashing a disarming grin, hands up as if to say, "Don't take it out on me," even though he could probably beat all three of us up at the same time.
Actually, it's time for that meeting in the Grand Hall, he says. Borjigin said to make sure we weren't late.
Again with a damn meeting. Spingate runs a hand through her thick red hair.
She sighs heavily, as if trying to clear the stress from her body.
Yes, the meeting, she says.
We should all go now, together.
I point to the blue dot.
This is more important. We have at least a day, Gaston says. If we don't do this meeting now, we might not get to do it at all. I'm told it's very important.
Spingate claps her hands. The students all look up at her.
Everyone, to the Grand Hall, she says. Right now.
The students exchange excited looks as they rush out of the room. Does everyone know what this is about except me?
Halim puts his arm around my shoulders.
Help me out, Em. If you're not on time, Borjigin said he would come down here and yell at me. I'm a delicate soul. I might wither and die.
I can feel the strength in his muscular arm. He is a circle star, after all. You might wither and die, I say. I find that hard to believe.
Did I mention how delicate I am? What if I say pretty please?
He smiles wide. Halim rarely asks for anything. I look at Spingate and Gaston. They're also smiling. Whatever this is, everyone is in on it. I sigh, and I give in. Fine, let's go. Seven. The four of us walk towards the Grand Hall. It is the largest room in the observatory. At least it's the largest one we've found so far. This place is full of hidden doors and hallways. We're still discovering new areas almost every week. We've had several all-hands meetings in the Grand Hall. It's quite beautiful. Large marble columns support an arched stone ceiling. There were carvings of torture and human sacrifice, but we covered those with large tapestries made by the Springers. I like the hall, but one part of it really bothers me. A raised dais with an obnoxious golden throne. I'm sure that's where Matilda thought she would rule. The left side of the throne has a bracket that holds a ceremonial golden knife, its pommel decorated with a double ring symbol done in rubies. The right side holds a thin red cane, a working rod, the torture device used to punish people, especially children. Matilda used an identical rod on me when I was her captive. The pain! I shiver involuntarily every time I see the thing, which is why the entire throne is covered in a blanket made of Huracan fur. Out of sight, yes, but not out of mind. We all know the throne is there, a constant reminder of the evil that built this city. None of us have sat in that throne. None of us ever will. Spin, Gaston, and Halim and I walk down the stone corridor. I hear noise coming from the Grand Hall, loud conversation. Laughter. And is that music? We reach the entryway. One step inside, and I stop cold. This huge room is full of people and Springers. So many of us here. Maybe all of us. I think everyone has bathed, even those who fought with me against the belligerents. Bodies washed, hair combed. Most of my people wear Springer-made clothes instead of the familiar black coveralls. And our Springers, hundreds of them, all dressed up. Long robes of fine cloth, in so many wonderful colors. Hems and collars trimmed in bits of gleaming glass.
Buttons of polished metal with intricate patterns.
Everyone looks so nice. The music stops. All heads turn to stare at me. Spingate, Gaston, and Halim take a step away from me. They look at me and smile. Gaston starts to clap. Spingate joins him, then Halim, then everyone. They are applauding. Applauding me. My face feels hot. What's going on? Borjigin slides out of the crowd. He wears a new blue outfit, beams with pride and joy. He takes my hand and leads me into the hall. Everyone, let's hear it for our leader. Let's hear it for M. They clap harder. They hoot and holler. I see smiles from Bishop, Opkick, the shuttle kids, Victor. I must be the only person who wasn't in the know. Borjigin, I say, what is this? He pulls me in for a hug. It's a celebration of your triumph in battle. A way for those of us who did not fight to thank those that did. I had it planned all along as a ceremony, but when you told me we didn't lose anyone, I turned it into a party. He leads me around the room. There are tables full of food, meats and cheeses, pastries, a whole roasted Omayokan piggy sitting on a large silver tray, candies and treats, platters full of unwrapped grain bars from our food warehouse. The Springers consider those a delicacy. I see another table topped with a pile of small black circular cookies, also from the storehouse, and standing next to that table, of course, is Farrar. He smiles at me, chewed up cookies caked on his teeth. He always did have a sweet tooth. There are exhibits, too. Callie is behind a pedestal, its glowing display showing some kind of wiggling worm thing. I see three shuttle kids with instruments, one with a harp of some kind, one with a brass trumpet, one with several small drums set up around her. Two displays of paintings. Not Springer paintings, I'm shocked to see, but human ones. A table where black-haired little Bernice Whalezak is talking to a dozen people. She wears white robes, smiles like an angel. Borjigin sweeps his arms wide, a gesture that includes the band, the people, the food, the exhibits, everything. Important things happened while you were gone, he says. And there were some things happening while you were here, but you were too busy to notice. I wanted to take a moment and bring all of these things together so you could see that you're fighting for far more than just survival. Art, science. This is the culture we're all building together. Building because of you, Em. Because of your leadership. All this attention, all focused on me. I'm grateful, but I hate it. Borjigin finally seems to notice how uncomfortable I am. He looks at the people gathered around. We have about an hour, he calls out. Then most of us need to get back to work. Eat, drink, learn, and enjoy. The crowd applauds again, maybe this time more for him than for me. Then they return to what they were doing. The music starts up. The room fills with the sounds of conversation. I'm used to being the center of attention, but not like this. I'm embarrassed. I'm also very touched. Borjigin, you shouldn't have done this. He laughs. You never ask for anything for yourself, so I took it upon myself to show you how much we appreciate what you do. This celebration isn't just for you, of course. Take a look at your soldiers. Victor is tearing into a plate overstuffed with steaming piggy meat. A bandage covers the burn wound on his head. He's eating and laughing, talking to Louise Barroso, one of our halves. Bauden is in a wheelchair. The plate on her lap holds a small roasted animal. I recognize it. It's the same animal Visca found right before he was killed. How I miss him. Maria and Lafa are laughing and dancing together in front of the little band, along with a young Circle Star girl named Inez Darzi. They've all traded in their dirty jungle rags for long scarves of all colors that flow in time with their movements. The people who fought with me, human and Springer alike, just a few hours ago they were putting their lives on the line. Now they are playing, laughing, enjoying this moment like there is no tomorrow. With the basilisk coming in, maybe there isn't a tomorrow. They should have fun while they can. We all should. Borjigin is clapping in time with the band.
They're wonderful, I say.
The Springers made the harp, Borjigin says. We found the trumpet and the drums in the storage room. Malene, Arthur, and Fernanda have been working on their instruments for weeks.
Malene, Arthur, and Fernanda are all Circles. I had no idea our people could be musicians. I point to the paintings.
And those?
Duke uses paint provided by the Springers, Borjigin says. Barbara uses charcoal. They were both hiding their art away like they thought it would get them in trouble or something.
I shake my head. Duke Cattleman and Barbara Duchesne, both shuttle kids, and both Circles.
You said there were important discoveries?
Borjigin takes my hand and leads me to Callie's pedestal. She waves everyone away so she can focus solely on me. She has such a sweet smile. Unfortunately, what usually comes out of her mouth is anything but sweet.
Sorry those goddamn jungle rats burned our crops, she says.
I can't even guess how many hours she invested in developing that cornfield. I don't blame her for being angry, but at the same time, I don't need her racism.
Callie, we have guests, I say. Can you mind your language, please?
She huffs, then glances at Lafa and a few other Springers.
It's just a word, Em, she says, but not as loud. Words can't hurt you. They can't. Tell that to those who died in Aramovsky's war. Besides, the Springers aren't rats.
Close enough for my tastes.
You've never even seen a rat. She laughs. But I remember what they look like, don't you?
I do. I didn't at first, but when some people started calling the Springers jungle rats, I looked it up on one of the observatory's pedestals. Once I saw it, I remembered it, meaning that Matilda knew about rats when she was a little girl. The only memories that are truly mine are the ones that came after I woke up in my coffin, in the dark, screaming and fighting for my life.
I'm glad you beat them, Callie says.
Her tone is slightly more respectful.
Did you kill them all?
No, not all.
Too bad.
I don't bother telling her that those who survived will probably all die at the hands of Barca. She waves her hand above the pedestal. An image sparks to life. It's the purple vine root. We use its juice to neutralize the toxic mold that makes all the food on this planet poisonous.
I finally had a breakthrough with this thing, she says. Magnify.
The image zooms in on one spot of the root as if we are plunging into it at high speed. What looked like smooth skin is actually marked with tight wrinkles. We dive further, through those wrinkles, into the flesh itself. Tiny dots appear, which grow into irregular cubes packed in together.
Those cubes are plant cells, Callie says. Increase magnification.
The cubes seem to expand. I see that there are dots in the middle of each one, something at the center of the cell. Then I see movement, something long and thin, sliding between the cubes. I point at it.
What is that? It's a microorganism. I first saw them months ago, but assumed they were just a pest of some kind. My recent experiments, however, show that the worms secrete a manganese compound that kills the mold and neutralizes the mold's toxin.
Borjigin nudges me.
Told you things happened while you were gone, he says.
I stare at the image while my brain catches up with what Callie just said. I don't understand all her words, but I think I get her meaning.
So it's not root juice that makes our food safe to eat, I say. It's worm juice?
Callie laughs.
A disgusting yet accurate way to describe it, sure.
Does this worm thing eat the root?
No, she says. I believe the worms eat waste from the plant cells. Without the worms, in fact, I think the roots would die, killing the vine. Do you know what the word symbiotic means?
I shake my head.
It means that two or more organisms are interdependent. Sometimes it means two species live in close association that may be, but is not necessarily, beneficial to each other. What we have with the roots and the worms is called obligate symbiosis. Do you know what that means?
She's really starting to annoy me.
Obviously, I don't.
She shrugs.
Who can tell with you? You're always so full of surprises. Obligate symbiosis means the two species can't survive without the other. Without the worms, the vines die. Without the vines, the worms die.
Borjigan is excited and getting impatient.
Tell her the best part, he says.
Callie points at the image. Her fingertips touch the worm, sending up a little cloud of multicolored sparkles.
I think I can modify the worms so they become symbiotic with our corn, she says, and our turnips, and all our crops. The mold isn't just toxic to us, it's toxic to the plants the grown-ups sent down here. That's why everything we grow looks so sickly. If I can get the worms to live symbiotically with our crops, we'll be able to grow our own food.
Despite the unknown threat orbiting us high above, despite the dangers lurking in the jungle, for the first time, we have real hope at a permanent survival on Omayokan.
How long will it take to make it work?
Callie shrugs.
I couldn't say. Years, maybe? From what I've learned so far, I'm sure I can do it, but it's going to take a shucking long-ass time.
Borjigan frowns at her.
Callie, language, you know Em doesn't like that.
She grins at him.
It's just words.
Maybe they are, but I've had enough. I can only take Callie in small bits. I walk to the paintings, admire the work. It's really quite impressive. My people can make art. I wouldn't have known if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes. Walezak is leading a few people in prayer. I'm not crazy about religion, but I do notice her robes are white, not red like Aramovsky wore. Her message sounds peaceful and positive. I glance at Borjigan.
You left Aramovsky in his cell, right? And Bello?
He nods.
I wouldn't remove either of them without your permission. You know that.
He looks around the room.
Aside from them, the only ones missing are Zubiri and Okariki. No one could find them. They knew about the party. Zubiri was looking for parts for the Goff spear. Maybe she found another hidden room.
I'm glad at least someone is still working. Make sure Aramovsky and Bello get some of this food, I say.
But no plate or utensils for Bello, I know, Borjigan says. I'll see to it.
I get a plate. The piggy is delicious. Farrar gives me some cookies for dessert. He's all smiles and laughter. Everyone is having so much fun. Yes, the alien ship is close. In a couple of days, we could all be at war. That's what makes this happy moment even more precious. This is what we're fighting for. Someone pushes through the people on my right. It's Zubiri.
I found something, she says.
The brilliant gear has grown. She's almost as tall as I am. Zubiri is still young, but her beauty already rivals that of Spingate. Dark brown skin, darker eyes. Her black hair is a soft, curly cloud. She is one of the few people who prefer the same outfit we were born in, white button-down shirt and a plaid skirt. We found thousands of those outfits in the observatory storerooms, in all sizes. Her clothes fit perfectly. For all her beauty, though, there is no hiding the damage this world has done to her. Her left sleeve is rolled up and pinned closed just below her elbow.
She lost the arm in Aramovsky's war. Smith has done wonders repairing Zubiri's ruined face and broken teeth. But the girl will never get her arm back. Hi, Zubiri, I say. I tilt my head towards Victor. Are you and your boyfriend going to dance? She starts to shake her head, stops when she glances at Victor. He doesn't seem to notice she's there. Her eyes cloud over for a moment, shimmer with wetness. Then Zubiri finishes that paused shake of the head.
No time for that, she says. I found something very important. I need you, Spingate, and Gaston to come with me right now.
Zubiri is worried, and maybe more than a little afraid. I glance at Borjigin, not wanting to spoil his party. He sighs.
Well, I got you to enjoy 30 minutes of fun, which is better than nothing. Go, I'll get everybody back to work in a little bit.
I stand on tiptoe and kiss his cheek.
Thank you, I say. I really mean it.
And with that, I gather up Spingate, Gaston, and Halim.
We follow Zubiri out of the Grand Hall.
That was Alone, episode number 4. What has Zubiri found? What is so important? What does this discovery mean for the birthday children? In other words, is the party both literally and figuratively over? You will find out next week when we come back for Alone, episode number 5. And until then, I will talk to you all real soon.
You have been listening to Alone, book 3 in the Generations trilogy. Written by Scott Sigler. Performed by A. Kovacs. Produced by Scott Sigler and engineered by Steve Rickyberg. Follow Scott on Twitter and Instagram, where his handle is at Scott Sigler, S-C-O-T-T-S-I-G-L-E-R, one word, or join our Facebook group at facebook.com/Scott Sigler. Theme music is the song Unseen Horrors by Kevin MacLeod.